This is side two of tape 437. It's April the 11th, 1980, and this is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. I do want to update a few items with you in the news we don't want to lose track of. I mentioned on other tapes the dilemma of the Shah of Iran, a very important man in regards to American foreign policy. And there was an important article that you might have missed that was in the Washington Post just recently, April the 3rd, 1980, because I said that the Shah was taken from Iran to Egypt and Morocco, the Bahamas, and then to Mexico and New York, Ashland Air Force Base in Panama, that he was under house arrest because so much of his investments are in some very important banks in New York City, particularly the Chase Manhattan Bank in the interests of the Rockefellers, and that the Shah has to be under house arrest because he blames Jimmy Carter and the powers that be in Washington for not protecting his peacock throne. And he could retaliate if he wanted and write a check and pull his money out of these banks and bankrupt them very nicely, put it in money overseas. And one reason he went to Panama was hopefully to invest in Panama. But the representatives of David Rockefeller have been very close to the Shah, Mr. Armeo, and others to see that he, I'm sure, cannot write a check and pull the money or the rug out from under our banks in New York City. And to support that was an article in the Washington Post, Shah's aid hits the U.S. attitude. And it tells how angry he was. This is from Cairo when he got there. He said, in my 37 years, I did everything in my power to help and assist my allies. And then it tells the problem they had at the Panamanian hospital and the confrontations with the doctors and how the representatives from up north, Mr. Armeo and Mr. Jordan from the White House, tried to keep the Shah from leaving Panama and having the surgery there. The New York Times article said these arguments followed a series of earlier disputes. Oh, I'm sorry, this is from the Washington Post. Between the Shah staff, particularly Armeo, that's the representative of David Rockefeller and Chase Manhattan, and Panamanian officials assigned to guard the monarch in his refuge on Contadora Island. Armeo said the Panamanians resented the efforts to bring costs under control, and the Shah stay was running up to a six-figure price tag every month. And he believed that they were blocking the access to the Shah's wealth for investment in Panama. There was a big argument because the possibility that the Shah would invest in Panama, and that would mean pulling his money out from the United States, and there was a confrontation there. The article said, once the Shah decided to accept Sadat's offer to go to Cairo, Armeo said the pressure game started. When the U.S. and Panamanian governments were informed that the Shah was going to leave Panama, the ambassador, Moss, and Torrijos moved quickly to try to reverse the situation. See, the Shah was under the arrest in hands of Torrijos in Panama. U.S. officials urged Abaki to accept their assessment that the operation could be carried out in Panama. They didn't bend, he added to Abaki and the others on the Shah's medical team. The Shah didn't want them to bend. This week, the Shah came out and said that he was afraid if he was under the anesthetic, they were going to return him to Iran. And this tells the conflict of the staff that were fighting to keep the Shah in Panama and not let him get to Egypt. The White House entered into the negotiations with the Shah's New York lawyer, William Jackson, a partner in the prominent firm of Milbank, Tweed, Hadley, and McCloy. Of course, John J. McCloy has been a part of this scene of the overthrow of Mossadegh and helping the Shah get in and the oil profits with Chase Manhattan. He was chairman of the Bank of Chase Manhattan. He was also a lawyer on the Warren Commission, the commission to investigate the assassination of John Kennedy, representing David Rockefeller and the people that were instrumental in having Kennedy killed. The Washington Post said on the evening of March the 20th, Hamilton Jordan, an acquaintance of Torrijos, arrived in Panama to handle the discussion in person. In the end of the week, he was met by the attorney for the President of the United States, Lloyd Cutler, but the Shah insisted on going to Cairo. So there's this tremendous pressure to control the Shah and not get him out of their hands. And as soon as the Shah was in Cairo, so Sadat came flying to the United States to the Rose Garden, and I'm sure that he will be paid heavily with weapons and ammunition for Egypt if he keeps the Shah from writing any checks until he dies from his cancer. I'm not defending the Shah any more than I do Martha Mitchell at the time of Watergate, but when you see how they play and kill and manipulate their friends, the power structure, you realize that they'd have very little mercy for us. And they have very little mercy for us. Speaking of Jack Anderson, he had an article that you might have missed. Some of you don't get his articles. It's a shame. You could go to the library and look up the papers that have them. We get one daily. An article, April the 4th, last week, 1980, the Drug Enforcement Agency death plot tie alleged. I mentioned on other tapes and radios that the reason the Shah was safe in Panama with an old drug dealer like Torrijos is the United States had control over him and literally owned him, and at one time they planned to assassinate him. This was cut short at the time of Watergate, and the assassination teams were being exposed. Jack Anderson wrote just last week, General Omar Torrijos, now in the center of a controversy involving the Shah of Iran, was the intended victim of an assassination plot in 1973. In December 77, I reported the rumors that the Watergate plotters, that was G. Gordon Liddy and E. Howard Hunt and Mr. Lucian Conein and so forth, had marked Torrijos for assassination. Now a long-buried Justice Department document is coming out from the Drug Enforcement Agency involving the alleged Watergate plot to assassinate Torrijos. The report was submitted by Michael DeFeo, head of the Justice Department team in 1975, investigating fraud, irregularities of conduct in the Drug Enforcement Agency at the time that Richard Nixon was in the drug agency. The DeFeo report is a confidential briefing of the narcotics connections and the links of the CIA to drug enforcement agencies. And they, as Jack Anderson said last week, they had a plan to kill Torrijos. The DeFeo report goes into assassinations concerning killing Mr. Noriega, N-O-R-Y-A-G-O, Noriego, the principal assistant to the president of Panama, Torrijos, and that Smith and William Durkin actually proposed, these men from the Drug Enforcement Agency, that he be killed. What's interesting, Jack Anderson said, is the Drug Enforcement Agency did not figure in the assassination stories at the time. It was a repository for the CIA alumni, particularly Lucian Conein, a colorful ex-CIA operative who at the time of the White House in 1972 was put from the CIA assassination teams into the Drug Enforcement Special Operation. He promptly recruited in the Drug Enforcement Agency 14 CIA colleagues for his 19-member undercover team. Now, Jack Anderson, I'll finish the article with him and then go into some points of the article he's written. He said the reference to the assassination plans to kill Torrijos and so forth in the DeFeo report have 20 allegations of misconduct of Drug Enforcement Agency, including a covert intelligence project in the Caribbean, the use of non-conventional investigative techniques in Panama, improper involvement in gambling interests in Las Vegas, and a questionable relationship between the drug enforcement personnel and Intertel, a private security force. Intertel is the Howard Hughes, Summa Corporation narcotic link that I mentioned before that is linked to Paul Lexalt and Ronald Reagan and the Justice Department and the gambling casinos in the Bahamas and up to the Ab scam and the Bri Lab up to New Jersey and Las Vegas. Now, Jack Anderson is writing about the drug enforcement agents that were never disciplined. Conein from the CIA is higher in the drug enforcement hierarchy than ever. This is April 1980. He's in charge of their strategic intelligence. Mr. Smith, as part of this assassination team from the Drug Enforcement Agency, left Drug Enforcement Agency to work for Intertel and is now setting up their surveillance system for the Great Bay Casino in Atlantic City. You see how important these things will tie together, the assassination teams, Atlantic City, New Jersey, organized crime. Another drug enforcement agent spook was not so fortunate. Santo Barrio was involved in drug enforcement Operation Croupier to penetrate gambling interests, Jack Anderson said, and he recently died under disputed circumstances. I didn't catch the article of Santos Barrio in the paper, but I have some very good listeners who take the tapes, and if you find the death of Santo Barrio from Drug Enforcement Agency, even Jack Anderson in April 4th of 1980, is talking about a death of somebody mysteriously. Now, he's talking about this document, Drug Enforcement Agency and Organized Crime. I have a full set of that report. It was sent to me by the Scientology Church. It's the report, June 18th, 1975, to the Attorney General, Michael DeFeo, and two other agents. And on page 9 of this report, they refer to the source of their weapons, the V.R. Fox Laboratories, Conin, working for drug enforcement agencies, purchased weapons from the Fox Laboratories from Alexandria, Virginia. And, of course, those are the laboratories of Mitchell Werbel and the Central Intelligence Agency that have supplied weapons and silencers to Conin, the assassination teams of the CIA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, and those men that were arrested, the arms merchants of the world that were arrested in December of 1979 this year, Frank Turpel and George Kirkcala, who linked to England and Monte Carlo to the world supplier of weapons. This talks about Conin and where they got their weapons. I could sometime do a whole tape on 40 pages of the drug enforcement article. There's an article about this same operation of planning to kill Torrijos in the San Diego Union, May 23, 1978, San Diego newspaper about the assassination teams, the operations, and a John Ingersoll, who was head of Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs in 1972, who was trying to immobilize Panama, who was taking over the operations in Panama, and this has to do with the plans to kill Trujillo. That came out in 1978. Jack Anderson's article came out in 1980. The report from DeFeo was in 1975, but May Bressel in 1973, in the Realist article, the summer of 73, I wrote my second published article. The first was in 1972, Why Was Martha Mitchell Kidnapped, for the Realist. And if you don't have this other article, you should send for them. They're a dollar plus the postage while they remain. My second published article for Paul Krasner was The Senate Select Committee is Part of the Cover-Up. That's the one of the picture of Truman Capote on the cover in a fishbowl. And in that article, I talked about the illegal criminal spy operations of the Central Intelligence Agency that were linked to Richard Nixon, who was still in power at the time. And I mentioned the Latin American tour and the crises that he promoted down there, the U-2 flight, Downing, the peace conferences with Lee Harvey Oswald and Gary Powers in the Soviet Union, playing a part to break up the peace conference that Richard Nixon didn't want, but which President Eisenhower wanted, but his Fink vice president, of course, didn't want, and the Bay of Pigs operation that Richard Nixon headed, and then the assassination of John Kennedy, mentioning last week how Nixon was in Dallas at the home of Clint Murchison, the close friend of Irv Davidson of ABSCAM fame. And then I mentioned in August of 1973 that Richard Nixon and his team planned to assassinate the president of Panama in 1971. Mr. Hunt and Liddy, working in the White House, used Operation Intercept, that was the Drug Enforcement Agency, as their cover. The president of Panama was not cooperating in the control of narcotics, and one of their jobs was to kill him. I published that in The Realist in 1973. And now Jack Anderson is coming in 1980, April 4th, 1980, 7 years later, finding a long-buried document on not only the plans to kill the president of Panama, Torrijos, but to control the assassination teams, not only in the CIA, but in the Drug Enforcement Agency, and the use of people from those assassination teams to kill one of their important investigators, mentioning by name, and also linking to Atlantic City and the casinos in Atlantic City, the killer team moving in, organized crime, the CIA and the Justice Department working in Vegas, in the Bahamas, and in Atlantic City. Now, the country, because it can't stand so many bank robberies, extortion, stolen paintings, and all the various crimes, the blackmailing, eventually, if they try to solve any of these huge white-collar crimes, they're going to get to the assassination teams. But Torrijos' name came out in the news last week, and that's why it was safe to let the Shah in the hands of the President of Panama. He had to flee at that particular date because a report was coming from Iran, 600-page report to be presented on the crimes of the Shah, but Torrijos delivers, and now we have Mr. Sadat holding his Shahness so that he can't write checks and bankrupt, pull the money out. He is a prisoner, but Torrijos is a very important person because of the control that the United States have. They can either order him to obey or they can kill him, and they've allowed him to rule there because they can control him so well. Besides that, Panama is the location of the police station of training American police. They can't be trained domestically by the Central Intelligence Agency, and according to Fletcher Prouty, who wrote me a letter on this matter, they're sent to the police academies from Los Angeles, San Francisco, Fresno, your police departments, Minneapolis, wherever they are. The policemen can be sent to Panama for police training work, and that's where they learn the torture and the Nazi techniques. That's why there's so many death squads in police departments around the country, so many witnesses being shot, so many people being tortured, and even in Detroit, they've been branding people with hot irons. And police abuse and police torture is in the news every single day. I'll give you a little homework project. Whatever city you live in, wherever you are, cut out every murder, car crash of a young person, a political activist, an organized crime member, an Italian politician. Save those, and maybe once a month, the first of the month or so, send me a pack of death, musicians, writers, and so forth, and let me assimilate them with my material and see if they are coming together and are important to the sum of the work I'm doing. One of the very fine researchers, he's fairly new at it, but he's caught on very quickly, lives up in the Bay Area near here, near Palo Alto, saw an article in the San Francisco Chronicle that was not in my version of the San Francisco Chronicle. We get a later date down in the peninsula. It's dated the same, but doesn't read the same. And it has to do with a man named Frederick Schwend. And it was a short article. It just said, Lima, Peru, former Nazi major Frederick Schwend, 80 years old, who printed counterfeit pounds and dollars in a bid to ruin the economy of Britain and the United States, died last week, the news report said. The Lima newspapers said that Schwend had been sentenced to death in absentia in Italy for war crimes, and they recalled he took part in the Nazi operation, and then there's this disclaimer, not carried out, aimed at destabilizing the United States and British economy and flood Europe with fake dollars and pounds in the early 40s. Of course, I have an entire book on that called Bernhard, and there is a lot of documentation that they did use this money to flood the markets and to resurge the Nazis and take counterfeit money and put in Swiss banks in the savings accounts of Evita Peron. I've mentioned four of those. But Schwend is a very important person, and I don't know if any of you picked this up in any of your local newspapers. I always say that the Washington Post and the New York Times are great at obituaries, but would you believe that this death was March 30th of this year, and there hasn't been a single mention of it in any of the newspapers around except this little itty-bitty corner. I got out one book, so many books on Nazis, just for a view of this character, Mr. Frederick Schwend, who passed away and in aftermath. Farrago, Laszlo Farrago, describes Mr. Schwend, and I think it's a good book, and I'll just give you a few quotes. He talks about Heinrich Müller, the highest-ranking Nazi to leave Rome when the war was over, and how he stayed in a monastery in northern Italy, just as did Martin Bormann. He got his passport from what was the International Red Cross to let him leave. Of course, last week I mentioned the Red Cross signs on an airplane that flew out 142 people from Nicaragua when Somoza was kicked out. Mr. Müller entered an Argentine ship. He got to South America in 1950 wearing the garb of the Vatican, again, the priestly garb that Nazis wore to be sent all over the world, and he used the name Hans Rosa. He became an insurance salesman down in South America. And along with him came these other Nazis, and the secretary of the Vatican, Montini, who became Pope Paul VI, was writing passports for these Nazis. And among them, living down there in South America with Martin Bormann and Mr. Rudell in Chile and Mr. Scorzini and Mengele, was Schwend.
is Frederick Schwen, and he describes how Schwen went to Lima, Peru, and his friend Klaus Barbie, who took the name Altman, went to La Paz. And before long, they were front for drug pushing and gun running. Now, I've mentioned from many sources of books the Nazi resurgence by using money from South America, narcotics, and gun running. We send guns down to them, and then the ships come back with narcotics, and we send more guns down and supply them, just like American printers in two states of the United States are shipping literature to Germany about Nazism. It can't be printed there. And so behind the facade of ships going back and forth for other purposes, the guns go down and the dope comes back, and it funds, recycles itself, and millions of dollars went into this operation. Now, it's an interesting thing. Laszlo Fargo writes about a man named Mr. Rossi, important man down in Lima, Peru, rancher, Luis Ranchero Rossi. And he was part of this shipping tycoon industry of shipments going back and forth, a very wealthy man, and he died quickly or mysteriously in the hands of Freddie Schwen and Klaus Barbie Altman, two Nazis. And Mr. Farrago wrote or believed that their funding and operation for gun running and narcotics escalated when Mr. Rossi died. That reminds me of a man by the same name, a Mr. R-O-S-S-I, who ran a restaurant in the mercantile business, mercantile bank, where H.L. Hunt has his offices in Texas, not the mercantile business, the mercantile bank. And Mr. Rossi ran restaurants there, and Jack Ruby frequented it. And Jack Ruby asked Rossi if he wanted to be a business partner. He was going to come into a lot of money. This was Wednesday that Jack Ruby was in the offices of H.L. Hunt with a woman named Connie Trammell, who had links to the Republic National Bank, identified in 1967 as black money, as CIA espionage money for assassination. Connie Trammell worked with men from Germany that came over from Young Americans for Freedom, that worked with General Walker, H.L. Hunt, and he took Connie Trammell to Mr. Hunt's office the Wednesday before John Kennedy was assassinated. And when he came down, Rossi talked to Ruby, and Ruby said he was coming into a lot of money. When I look back and see men like Rossi being murdered down in Lima, Peru, and being involved with organized crime and gun running and narcotics and Nazis and resurgence of Nazis, I wonder if Jack Ruby had any part of the operation with a Rossi who is related to this Rossi. These are things we'd have to have people out in the field looking up. I only say it's a coincidence of names because Ruby wanted to be his partner, and Rossi was murdered so that Schwen and his buddy could continue the operations down in Lima, Peru. There's quite a bit of it in the book, Aftermath, about Freddie Schwen and his operations and how the hoax of Martin Bormann's death, the story that was in many books that Martin Bormann died, was completely planned by Schwen. According to Fargo, that was made up by Schwen, that he had something to do with disseminating the story, and then Martin Bormann and Schwen and all of them ended up in South America, all of their buddies down there. Interesting to look up his name in the index of various books on the Nazi role that he had in the operation called Bernhardt, because here is a very important man who died March 30th, and except for one listener who takes the tapes, who lives up in Palo Alto, I would never have known that the man had deceased. And after I read this, then I began to look up references. He's a very important man, of course, and interesting to the history of our times, because, as I said at the beginning of this tape, the United States is a captured nation. We couldn't compete with the phony millions and billions of blackmailed money that was put aside and printed to be used a few years after the war, when the Cold War period came. I have a book which goes into the Schwen operation called Operation Bernhardt by Anthony Peary. The front cover of the book alone says, "The story behind the greatest forgery of all time, 100 million in counterfeit English notes." Of course, they duplicated American money and German money and French money and Italian money. And when the war, before the war was over, they were sampling it in banks to see if anybody could pick up the counterfeit money. This Bernhardt operation involved even engravers that they took out of concentration camps to use to make this huge amount of wealth. This is why I say the United States as a nation cannot survive with the Central Intelligence Agency, the secrets, the blackmail, the organized crime, not even to mention the pollution and mind control and medical experiments and the DNA and the gene banks and so forth, what they're doing to us physically. But economically, there's no way to fight the way that money was produced and reproduced and financed and manipulated, because the minute the intelligence community or the FBI or any honest investigator opens the door of these putrid activities, it all gushes out, and it is the cause of so much bankruptcy. I hear the experts talk on radio on Sunday and on the evening news, and the analysts and the financiers, and they talk about the economy and the inflation, and they have different words, double-digit economy, and they worry about the price of gold or silver, but they never talk about what happened after World War II or the crimes, the multi-billion dollar crimes that are taking place now, the swindles and crimes that are allowed to happen, and the insurance company has to cover those, and then our insurance rates go up. The manipulation of the money market because of the combination of the intelligence community to the Nazi mentality has never been put on the table to be exposed for the damage it's done to our economy. The historians and economists try to treat these problems logically or reasonably, just like doctors try to treat the problems of hyperactivity of children. They don't go into the corporations that put the poison in the food to make them hyperactive. They come to the conclusion that red dye makes them hyperactive, but they don't know why it's put in there or why it's necessary. And the economists miss the point, the historians miss the point, that there was a purposeful intent to do to us what is happening, and that the only solution comes in unwinding the cast of characters that made this happen and the people that put them in a power to allow it to happen. Incidentally, in the book Operation Bernhardt, if you look in the references to Schwend, there are about 150 pages in a 300-page book on Frederick Schwend, and yet, as I say, his name wasn't in any of the newspapers except one morning edition of the San Francisco Chronicle. There are many, many pages about Mr. Kaltenbrunner, the Nazi that was an intel with J. Edgar Hoover and Adolf Hitler. There are pages about him and a Dr. Willie Holton and Bernhard Krueger. But Schwend is the main man in this whole book, Bernhardt and the Counterfeiting of Money. And he's a war criminal that should have been investigated, who died at the age of 80, and a thundering silence on any biography. And he died at a time when the mafia and gun running and organized crime was breaking. The Abscam story was breaking in March of 1930. Not that an 80-year-old can't die when he's 80, but J. Edgar Hoover was old, and again, he was poisoned. And one of the White House plumbers admitted how they had poisoned J. Edgar Hoover, and that was just days before George Wallace was shot, at the height of Watergate escapades, when assassinations were prevalent and more murders were planned. It's very important to note that Mr. Schwend has left this earth without hardly a person knowing it, at a time when his connections to organized crime, the CIA, the international connections, the gun running, and the fascist regimes were breaking in the newspaper. He expired, and there wasn't a word about him in the major newspapers. If there was, correct me and send it to me, because my editions didn't have a word. On Bernhardt and the operations of counterfeiting the money, it tells how he went to South America. It said Schwend was very wealthy when he left Germany. This is when he sailed out in the middle of 1945. He had 1,500,000 Swiss francs at the Vaduz branch in the Bank of Liechtenstein, a holding worth another 1,000,000 Swiss francs in Trieste property, a holding company of 350,000 marks in an Austrian import and export firm, 100,000 marks worth of securities, all earned from his work as the sales director for Operation Bernhardt. And he left Europe and settled in South America by the middle of 1945 and went on down there, and he was extremely wealthy. This book goes on to say how he settled in South America, slipped out of town, and it says by his going down there, we lost the last thread of the case. You better believe we did, because there were a lot of people that were going to use that money later and didn't want to develop it or tell you where it was. According to this author, Schwen's departure robbed the Allied investigators of one great source of knowledge, and he departed. The Bernhardt profits were never really exposed, and the author says we were deprived of this information. It is my charge and allegation that the Allied investigators encouraged him to take it, allowed him to take it. He left through the aid of the Vatican so that someday this money could come back and get the communists. And that's why we're in the mess we're in today. We're out of time as usual. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. I'll be with you next week. You take care and save your articles of accidents, deaths, murders and crimes. Even if you don't think they're important today, save them for a while and send them to me later so we can put the pieces together. In the meantime, you take care, and I'll be back with you next week.